The chair calls to order the Education Policy Committee for Tuesday, March 18th. And we do have a quorum, so thank you for that. And I'd like to welcome our new member, Representative David Gottfried. Would you like to just introduce yourself, Representative Gottfried? Just briefly tell us about who you are.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. My name is David Gottfried. I am the new representative for House District 40B in the Roseville-Shoreview area. My mom is a public school teacher, so education is near and dear to my heart. She was when I was growing up, too. So I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here and to get to work with you all. Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome to the team. I asked him what other committees he was on, then I informed him that this is the best committee because we have the best team here. So thank you very much. Representative Mueller, have you had a chance to review the minutes for Wednesday, March 12, 2025? And if so, would you approve the minutes?
I would move to approve the minutes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mueller moves to approve the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. And the minutes for Wednesday, March 12, 2025 are approved. Members, first on the agenda is House File 1124. Representative Joachim, welcome to the committee, Madam Chair. And while you're getting ready, Chair Jordan moves that House File 1124, moves that before the committee with the intent to lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further consideration at a later date. So, Representative Joachim, I understand you have an author's amendment. Members, let's get that amendment adopted. It's the DE1 amendment, should be in your packets. We'll put the bill in the shape the author prefers, and then Representative Joachim can present the bill as amended. So all those in favor of the DE1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Thank you for being so efficient. Sorry I was a bit late. The DE1 that you just put on just corrects the dates. I had put the wrong ones on and removes the report because school districts already report this information to MDE. So members, the current law requires our school districts to set their calendar start time after Labor Day. School districts can only start before Labor Day if they have a construction project of $400,000 or remodeling projects that's affecting a district school facility, or they have agreed to the same schedule with a school district in an adjoining state, or if they have a qualified flexible learning year, which we just talked about in education finance. As you look at House File 1124 as amended, you will note that it is adding an exemption to state statute 120A.40 so that individual school districts can start before Labor Day during the school years of just 26-27 and 27-28. And this is because Labor Day starts September 7th and then September 6th, respectively. Starting a school year this late cuts into a district academic days and pushes the end of the date of the school later into June. Individual districts have many, many items to consider when they set their school calendars, from an academic time for students and professional development for teachers to transportation schedules and secular and religious holidays. Allowing districts to start before Labor Day, these two school years in particular, will provide all districts with needed flexibility to work around the Labor Day start, a late Labor Day start. Members, I have two testifiers with me that would like to provide you with some more information about what schools have to consider when setting their school calendars and why this bill is necessary.
Thank you, Representative Joachim. Members, we do have those testifiers. And when the testifiers do come up, I'll ask you to state your name for the record and any organization that you represent. I will ask you to keep your comments to about 2 minutes. So let's start with Christy Peterson and Colin Cox, if they could come to the testifier table. And Christy Peterson, whenever you get situated there, go ahead and begin. Introduce yourself for the record.
Co-chairs Bennett and Jordan and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak on this bill today. My name is Christy Peterson, and I serve as the vice chair of the Shakopee School Board, and I'm also chair of the Southwest Metro Intermediate 288 School Board. I'm also here representing school board members from our 331 Minnesota public school districts in my role as president of the Minnesota School Board Association. House File 1124 aligns with MSBA's policy position on preserving local decision making by allowing school boards the flexibility to address the most pressing needs of their school districts, and that includes school calendars. I strongly support House File 1124 because it provides schools with much-needed flexibility to structure their academic calendar in a way that best serves our students, our families, and educators. We know that one size does not fit all school districts across the state. The needs of Shakopee are not the same as my hometown district of Ellsworth in the southwest corner of the state. A post-Labor Day school start has been a long mandate here in Minnesota that does not always align with the realities of education today. Currently, Minnesota school districts with construction projects exceeding $400,000 can request approval from the Minnesota Department of Education to begin the school year earlier, allowing for an earlier end date to maximize construction time while minimizing disruptions for our students and our staff. While this flexibility is beneficial for students undertaking major projects, many schools in greater Minnesota face significant construction needs that may not meet the financial threshold, leaving them with the option of an adjust, without the option of an adjusted calendar. In the 2026 and 2027 school years and calendar years, the Labor Day occurs on the latest possible dates. In 2026, it falls on September 7th, meaning public schools under the current state law cannot start until September 8th. The same situation presents itself in 2027. Labor Day lands on September 6th, resulting in a start date of September 7th. Allowing districts the flexibility, even for just these 2 years, to start before Labor Day has several benefits. The first benefit I'd like to highlight is the local control and the community choice. The important piece to House File 1124 is that it does not require or mandate an early start. And I just want to repeat that. It does not require or mandate an early start by school districts. It simply allows districts to make the best decision of when to start the school year based on their own local needs. Schools, families, and local leaders are in best position to determine what works for their students. This bill respects the local authority while assessing the impact of a calendar change. A second benefit is mitigating learning loss and also weather disruptions. We all know that assessments and testing are one of the more important pieces and one of the many pieces of the puzzle to measure a student's progress and overall achievement. Having the option to start school even just a week before Labor Day will help reduce the pressure that our educators feel, allowing them to deliver curriculums more effectively and giving students the best opportunity to succeed on tests and assessments that occur a little bit later in the year. Additionally, Minnesota's unpredictable winter weather, which we all know tomorrow could be one of those, often leads to school closures, especially in rural Minnesota. More flexibility in the calendar gives districts a buffer to adjust for snow days without extending the school year deep into June. A third benefit is more instructional time before key assessments. Many standardized tests, including AP and college entrance exams, as well as MCAs, are scheduled in the spring, typically at the beginning of May. Allowing an earlier start date provides students with additional instructional days before these critical assessments, better preparing them for success. I witnessed this with my own son a few years ago with his AP exams. Because of condensed schedules that resulted from snow days or a late start to the school year, sometimes teachers had a hard time trying to get all of the content in before those AP exams took place. And the fourth benefit that I'd like to highlight is better alignment with higher education schedules. Many Minnesota students participate in dual enrollment or post-secondary enrollment options, which follow a different academic calendar altogether. Starting even just a week earlier allows for smoother transitions and minimizes scheduling conflicts that can hinder participation in these valuable programs. By passing House File 1124, we empower our schools to make informed decisions that enhance student success. I urge the committee to support this bill and give our districts the flexibility they need to provide the best possible education for our Minnesota students. Thank you.
Thank you. And next we have Colin Cox. And these are your two presenters, correct, Representative Joachim? So thank you. Colin Cox, yeah. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Bennett, members of the committee and staff. I'm Colin Cox, School Board Chair for St. Louis Park Public Schools, and I'm also here on behalf of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, or AMSD. It's an honor to be here today, not only to represent St. Louis Park Public Schools and AMSD, but as a former session-long page who served on the Minnesota House of Representatives for the K-12 Education Committee in 1988. That experience allowed me to see all the good discussion and hard work that happens here at the Minnesota Legislature and experience some of the long hours firsthand. But my interest in this area began long before that, and I've never given up my passion for ensuring everyone gets a high-quality education. Today, I'm here to testify in support of House File 1124. Late last year, our staff brought forward a calendar for the 26-27 school year. When the staff showed that the end of our school year would be around June 15, you could see the concern across my fellow board members' faces. In St. Louis Park, we have been working hard to build a calendar around our community's needs and interests. We recognize that our families who celebrate Jewish and Muslim holy days often had to make a choice between celebrating as a family and a member of a faith community versus missing important classroom time. Balancing these community interests has not been an easy task. We also must consider days for our staff to partake in professional development, for our instructional staff to complete grading, and occasionally give everyone a break. In fact, we have 13 general concepts we build our calendar around for the school year. They range from instructional time, to teacher contract days, to transportation costs, to balancing the number of days in a semester. Reviewing our color-coded calendar with our administration is an exercise in patience and rivals an eye examination in the optometrist's office. And this is all before we have to also consider weather impacts, which are growingly more unpredictable. So while we understand the tradition of starting after Labor Day has a long history here in Minnesota, we are seeking more flexibility in our school calendar to meet our community's needs. Beyond considering all these needs, goals, and interests, there are additional benefits that would serve our students and likely students in other districts. Starting school earlier allows students to receive more instructional days before standardized tests, ensuring better preparation and improved academic outcomes. If opted to do so, a shorter summer break could help reduce summer learning loss, particularly for younger students and those in vulnerable populations, contributing to stronger long-term academic success. And it's not just about test scores. Many career and technical education programs require alignment with industry partners and internship schedules that begin before Labor Day, ensuring students receive hands-on learning opportunities without schedule conflicts. While we recognize that there is a construction-based exception rule to the Labor Day start, we have already made a number of improvements on our facilities, and we are a small district with few facilities. It would be challenging to conjure up projects for the sake of improving our calendar, not to mention it would be irresponsible to push this onto our community. What we are seeking is the opportunity to have local control so we can be flexible with our calendar. There is no way a statewide body or department can know the community calendar needs for all of our school districts. So we ask that you give that power to our school boards, who do have a pulse on what is needed in the community, especially when it comes to a calendar. Thank you for your service to our students, and thank you for this opportunity today.
Thank you. And now we have some public testifiers. We'll start with Hannah Zinn. And if our two presenters, yeah, could just maybe move to the back chairs there. Hannah Zinn and Joe Henry. And just a reminder for our public testifiers, try to keep your comments to about 2 minutes if we could, just to keep things moving. And we will start with Hannah Zinn first. So go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Bennett, Chair Jordan, and members of the committee. My name is Joe Henry, and I'm the Executive Director of Tourism up at Lake of the Woods, the walleye capital of the world. We represent the Rainy River, South Shore of Lake of the Woods, and the Northwest Angle, the northernmost point of the contiguous United States. You know, I'm also on the Board of Directors for both Hospitality Minnesota and the Minnesota Association Convention and Visitor Bureaus, MACVB. I'm here today to share my opposition to House File 1124, authorizing school districts to have a start date before Labor Day. You know, the Minnesota tourism industry believes it's important to keep a post-Labor Day school start for a number of reasons. You know, first off, summer is already a short season in Minnesota. It's a 12-week season, and safeguarding our 12 weeks is very, very important for the tourism industry, the hospitality industry, and all the different businesses that also benefit from tourism across our entire state. Now, secondly, we already lose a piece of June and August. You know, in talking some to some resorters before I came today, you know, they had mentioned that, geez, the way it is, you know, we're people are already busy going into the first couple weeks of June with graduation, with spring sport playoffs, things like that. So we're losing it on the front end, and with, you know, football and different things on the back end, we already lose a big part of our summer. To make it that everybody could, all the students would not be able to, you know, have a full summer would be very detrimental to our tourism industry. In addition, high school workers are very key to our hospitality businesses, and making it so a lot of these workers would have to go back to school prematurely would not be good for our industry. You know, up at Lake of the Woods, we have more than 60 hardworking small business owners that run lodging facilities. In talking to them, they said, please, please, please do not start before Labor Day. We already have a short summer in Minnesota, and this would really hurt us. Cutting back the summer season not only hurts tourism, but it also negatively affects our economy. Did you know that in Minnesota, for every dollar spent on lodging, there's a 5 to 7 time trickle-down effect to the local economy? If we hurt tourism in any way throughout our summer season across the entire state, that means we're hurting the economy in those areas as well. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in opposition of House File 1124. Thank you.
Thank you, and Hannah's in.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairs Bennett and Chair Jordan, and committee members. My name is Hannah Zinn, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for Hospitality Minnesota, which represents the state's restaurant, lodging, resort, campground sectors, and more. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in opposition of House File 1124, authorizing school districts to start before Labor Day. In Minnesota, the hospitality industry makes up over 384,000 jobs, averaging about 12% of the state's total workforce. Our industry is comprised of businesses of varying sizes, operating models, and economic impacts. The hospitality industry itself contributes $2.3 billion in annual tax revenue to the state and more than $8.1 billion in total labor income. We are strong supporters of the education system in Minnesota and believe that the post-Labor Day school start and positive educational outcomes are fully compatible. A previous 3-year trial period, which allowed 27 school districts in southwest Minnesota to start 2 weeks before Labor Day, failed to show any improvements in test scores. Additionally, citing no improvements in student academic outcomes and minimal cost savings, Minneapolis Public Schools announced in November of 2018 to return to resuming classes after Labor Day. The resort industry is declining. From the heyday of mom-and-pa resorts totaling over 3,000, Minnesota has fewer than 600 resorts operating today. Additionally, August is the main business month for resorts as families take the last days of summer to enjoy all Minnesota's outdoors have to offer. Finally, House File 1124 has no boundaries or guardrails on how early schools can start. Some may start August 1st, but would have the option of starting even earlier if they desired. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Next, we have Kayla, is it Daigle? I'm not sure. And Michael Bold. And when you get situated, we'll start with Kayla Daigle. So go ahead,
sure.
And when you're ready, introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Hi, I am Kayla Daigle. I own a resort, a small family-owned. My husband and I own a resort in Park Rapids, Minnesota. I'm also here representing the Community of Minnesota Resorts, where I'm the president. And then they don't know I'm here, but I also am on the Park Rapids Chamber of Commerce as well. So a couple different perspectives. I am here to oppose this. Like the previous speakers mentioned, very much the same points that I hope to make. Our business is squeezed into 3 months for our entire year's worth of livelihood, much of which the sales tax goes to the state of Minnesota and is a huge impact on the economy. Not to mention that most of us have side gigs as well, a lot of us family-owned resorts. One of mine is currently the interim assistant director of a new school in the Park Rapids area. Just this morning, I was getting some last-minute MCA and MTAS training in for our students. So I am pro-education. I have two kids in the public education system, of which I'm also serving. So I just want to glean and spark memories and love for the great outdoors that a lot of your constituents come to. We are the access point for so many of them. And as I was thinking about what stories, you know, to potentially share, I just wanted to embark the things that so many of these kids that come to our resorts learn outside of the classroom. There's so much learning that's happening while they come to our lakes and while they come to our small resorts. And I do also want to mention our small resorts are not conglomerates, developmental. You know, we live and work there. This is a lifestyle we've chosen where our kids are also raised there and also learn from the other students and families that come to our resorts. But just things like how many quarters does it cost to buy a candy bar in the lodge? I don't know if I'm too proud about this, but they learn how the credit system works a little bit. They get to charge to their cabin and write down for the first time probably in their life to charge a candy bar to their cabin and then, you know, ask grandma about it later. So things like that are really, really fun to see. My kids have got to experience the theater because I have students or I have kids come from the Twin Cities who are a lot of our guests, and they will share with my kids what it's like to be in a play, and they'll make a play right there and record it and make a video and edit it. So much is happening at our resorts. I just want to mention, if we shorten those weeks anymore, every time that week gets pushed in August a little bit more, students, parents, teachers are no longer choosing to go because the moment school starts, they have 2 weeks to get ready for it. So I know in my head, the last week of true summer is when my kindergarten teacher is at cabin zero. She's prepping to get ready for school that very next week. I also want to mention just the symbiotic relationship I've noticed between the education system and resorters. Just this morning, I was calling looking for a first grade sub. Who did I call? I called another resorter. So Scott from Wilderness Bay subbed in the first grade classroom for me this morning. Then the other sub I got this morning for a paraprofessional was my neighbor. I employ her daughter. I am her daughter's first ever employer, and I am the first employer for many teenagers. Also learning the importance of the work field, how to cash a paycheck. I'm not even kidding. Had to teach her how to cash her paycheck. So there's so much learning that's happening, and I just please urge you to keep Labor Day start post-Labor Day. Thank you. Thank you for letting me. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to come and testify today. My name is Michael Bolt. My wife, Tracy, and I own Cedar Point Resort in lovely Marcell, Minnesota. I am also a board member on the Community of Minnesota Resorters that represents 150-plus resorts. I am also on the Legislative Committee, so I have the unique opportunity to talk to many of the resorters about their concerns as being a resort. And as Kayla said, and a lot of the prior people who are up here, that, you know, one-third of our business happens in August, and it's critical to us. Most of our family-owned resorts are small. Many of them have a second or third job just to keep the resort afloat. It's critical that we have this extra time so we don't go under, because resorts are part of the community, and we bring, like, my resort alone brings 150 people in a week. And if our resort in little town of Marcell would happen to close their doors, because we're all right on the fringe, we don't get into resorting to be rich. We love to give back to the community. It would probably close the local restaurant and the gas station there without that number of people coming in. And our resorts are about education. I have some unique experiences walking out at midnight to do something that needs to be done, and I look out and there's 20, 30 people standing on the docks with their kids looking at the northern lights. Many of them, that's their only opportunity they have. They don't have a lake place to go to every weekend. Every week our resort does educational assignments. We take the kids out in the woods. We walk through the trails and along the shoreline, which we we have. We show them 150 to 250-year-old cedar trees. We show them the ecological system. We show them how the beavers make their dams, how the whole system works, because without that, the kids don't have an opportunity to learn how important our environment is, to show them where a loon makes their nest on a bog. So education happens just beyond that. And even more important is the time families have to spend with their children. And if we cut that short, they're not going to have that opportunity. Many times I see grandparents with their children and their grandchildren there, and they spend a week together. And if we eliminate that time, we're taking away from families building their relationships and sharing those unique experiences in the Northern Lake Country. So I just wanted to conclude and say that, you know, we're against the bill, but and all your support, you know, we appreciate all the support we get from that. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Joel Carlson and Ann Doherty. They could make their way to the testifier table. And when you get yourself situated, we will start with Joel Carlson, please. Ann Doherty, would you like to begin?
Hey, sure. Thank you so much for letting us be here. I don't want to be repetitive on lots of the other comments that have been said. My name is Ann Doherty. I am the co-owner of Wombolt's Cabins, which is one of the oldest resorts in Minnesota. We was homesteaded in 1899. My husband and I had a midlife crisis during the pandemic, and along with our five kids, decided to rehab the resort, which had been defunct for about 20 years. There are not a lot of people doing what we did. It has been the greatest joy of our lives in really surprising ways. And one of them is we didn't expect any returning guests. When you've been out of business for 20 years, you're not expecting people who are coming back. But they found us, all sorts of people who were there in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. And what they said to us was, the happiest days of my childhood were spent on this lake. And they brought their grandkids back, and they brought this deep connection. And for us, not expecting that, it was just really a lovely, wonderful gift to us. And it really made us recognize what stewards we are of this property. And everybody in Minnesota deserves a chance to have that lake experience. And what we're watching happen, and what was going to happen to the property that my husband and I purchased, is these parcels are being developed into private homes. And that's limiting what our Minnesota kids are having exposure to. The idea that you used to go to the lake, and you didn't have to own a cabin. You could just go up north for the week. Our bread and butter are middle-class families who are saving all year long to come up and do this. And it is absolutely a privilege to help them have a vacation, and we take it very seriously. These are not families that are going to Europe for the summer. They're not going to Hawaii. They are packing the car and taking some time with grandma or with grandpa and just being together, not on their screens and not on their phones. And it's a treat. So we need that. We need August. August puts us out of business. Even 2 years. If you let it go for 2 years, we're done. And I don't want that. I don't want it for us. I also am an educator. I have a master's degree in education and engineering. I can tell you, teaching in a hot classroom in August is not the most fantastic learning experience as well. So we shouldn't have to choose between quality education in Minnesota and access to our lakes. There have got to be a lot of ways that we can do this, but I don't think that starting before Labor Day is going to solve the problems for our students, and they deserve the best. Thank you.
And next, Joel Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul. Representative Godfrey, welcome to the committee. You have now waded into the great Labor Day debate. I have represented this family-owned resort community since 1997. And when I started, there were about 1,100 resorts, and we're now down to under 600. This is a survival issue for them. So I don't want to be over dramatic about how important this issue is, but the statistics and everything, I'm going to leave you with one when I finish, are really, really true and important as it relates to this industry. Lodging is the lifeblood of tourism. If you go north of 94, when that lodging goes away, So does the grocery store. So does the gas station. This is a critical issue. And as we know, it isn't just a few schools starting, you know, a week or two before Labor Day. We already know that over 80,000 kids gleefully participate in Minnesota high school athletics. They're not in our market anymore. And when you take out the rest of the pool, here's what the University of Minnesota Tourism Center found when they studied this issue. When school starts before Labor Day, families are 50% less likely to book a vacation in August. 50% of our pool goes away when you start school before Labor Day. That is just dramatic. And for an industry that pays almost 20% of the sales tax in the state and employs hundreds of thousands of people, this is a critical issue for us. Now, we've had this law for over 25 years. I've been on the Labor Day is really late this year fight at this table for, this is my fifth time now, right? Every 5 years we have this debate, oh, Labor Day comes so late. That has always been the case. And we've been through this fight before. The law's been in place, it works, and it helps balance the competing interests that I know you all have. We support schools. My dear friend, Representative Joachim, and I have had this debate many times. She goes to a resort. She knows the one. They have their week. She's not trying to do anything bad to us, but this really does have the potential to have very significant harm for particularly the resorting industry. So I hope that we can again resist this urge, support our school districts in any ways that we can, but maybe not this one. Thank you, Madam Chair. We're happy to answer questions.
Thank you. That concludes our public testimony. Members, do we have any discussion? We have Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And no, I was going to be first, but great.
Representative Mueller, 1 second. So maybe we could have the testifiers and then get the two presenters back up again. Would you like your presenters with you?
Oh, it's fine. I'll call them.
She's good. All right. Thanks. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Joachim. I'm an author on the bill. As a public school teacher for a long, long, long time, I understand, and I was talking to Representative Keeler, we have the shortest school day of all of the states, I think, and the school year. And so I know that this isn't popular, but when I was an active teacher in the classroom, I was advocating for a longer school year, but I know that wasn't as popular. Listen, I grew up going to the cabin as well. I know that teaching and learning happens outside. I just also know that, you know, there are so many other competing interests right now that, I mean, how many students are really working in the summer? And I think there should be more, but how many are working in the summer? There are elementary school kids that go to school other than just high school students. And when I went and looked at the days, you mean the testifiers were talking about starting in August. I went and looked at the days. Schools could start September 1. And that's September 1, 2025 is a Monday. They could start then. In 2026, September 1 is a Tuesday. Like, this isn't like we're starting at the beginning of August. And I taught in Indiana when you as a contracted teacher had to be in the classroom starting in August 1. August 1 is when you started to be in the classroom. And they have us pretty heavy agrarian and, you know, population as well. And that was what this was for. I don't want to minimize the impact that this will make on business. At the same time, we're talking about our kids' education. And we already heard from Bills in Education Finance about how we're expanding what instructional hours mean and that we're able to learn outside of the classroom. We're already hearing those bills and we're saying that that's exciting and those are necessary. I just really thank you for carrying this bill. And I know that this is really difficult and it's probably frustrating to have this, you know, debate every 5 years or so. You know, as a teacher for the last 20 years, my students never waited for breaks to take a vacation. I wish they would have, FYI. But I had kids gone all the time. And I was one of the weird ones where my mom worked at the school district, and so her summers were free, and so we took summer vacations. But there are lots of students that don't have that, and they have to use the weekends because their parents are still working during the day. And so, and during the week, like, it's not like every person gets their summers free to be able to go on a vacation wherever they want. And this is a person who covets time going up north. I have grandparents who live in Pequot Lakes. I go up north a lot, and I need it, and I love it. And I want everyone to be able to have that opportunity. The truth is that we also are talking about our kids' education. And so for the next 2 years, I think is okay. We already have fall sports starting way earlier, and it doesn't matter if it starts before Labor Day or not, fall sports are happening. I have kids who are in, well, not my own personal kids, but I have student kids. That counts, right? I have student kids who are in sports year round. And so culture has changed, and that doesn't mean we shouldn't do the best we can to help these businesses. I think we should help them by lessening their tax burden, their regulations and mandates. That's something that I think is really important for us to be able to do. But talking about our kids' education, I think this is really important. So thank you, Chair Youakim.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. It's like you're reading my notes, I think, over there. You did it in a little bit of a kinder way than I feel like I want to, because I'm going to agree with you. So first of all, just to name it, Minnesota is second in the nation in the lowest amount of days that we're already in school. Every other state goes 180 days. We go 165. So we already have a longer summer. We should take that into consideration. I also want to say the hospitality industry and what we're talking about is a privileged industry. Not all students across Minnesota have the right to be able to go to these resorts. I know that there's a lot of families that would love to, and don't come to the education committee and pretend like going to resorts is full of educational purposes. We've not seen you in this space before. We've talked about innovation learning. We've talked about getting out into the community. It's like, come join those conversations if you're so educational. Also, Chair Youakim, in the DE, I'm looking at it, line 1.6 says, a school board may vote. This is not a state mandate. This is local control. This is allowing our school boards the opportunity. All of the resorts that are here today can go to those school boards and have those conversations. You guys can go around to those school boards to allow them to do what they need so that they could vote if it's best for them. I represent Moorhead. We've been starting before Labor Day for as long as I know, and the reality is we're number one in the state for attendance. So there are things that work for us. I just think that it's really, really disappointing that the testifiers we heard today are utilizing our kids as workers instead of allowing them to be kids in the school district. And I think that I, you know, not often do I lean into your guys' talking points about the local control option, but I think that this is what it's doing. We're not creating a state mandate. We're not saying that schools have to do this. We're saying that schools have the opportunity to look within their own district if they're doing a project. We just had a massive high school renovation. We extended some of our breaks. It was great that we had the opportunity to do that to make the shifts. I think this is a great bill to give our school districts the option to do what is best for them in the community. Thank you, Chair Youakim.
Chair, no. Representative Gordon. Oh, is it Jordan?
Gordon.
Gordon. Sorry about that. A little dyslexia here. Representative Gordon. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. I completely agree with the testifiers, and I'll keep it pretty short here and sweet, but when I was a kid, I would skip school sometimes to go fishing or hunting with my parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and that kind of thing. But I'll just share one thing that my uncle used to tell me was, a bad day of fishing beats a good day of school. And that's all I have.
Very good, Representative Jordan. Gordon, okay. Chair Jordan, and I'm going to call you, I know technically co-chair, but I'm just, that's a mouthful. We'll
it's
just
a
call
mouthful.
You Chair. Chair Jordan, okay, there we go. Thank you. Oh, Representative,
I mean, okay, all right. Thank you, Chair. I did just have a quick question for somebody who may have some statistics behind them. So this year, Labor Day is September 1st, meaning that by law, we could start school on September 2nd for those schools that don't already have an exemption to that rule. So I'm just curious, what would the economic difference be between an August 31st start and a September 2nd start? Would somebody be able to speak to that?
Is there anybody? Any testifiers? Joel Carlson. Go ahead and state your name for the record, if you would, when you get situated there again, and then if you have any comments. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Gottfried, I'm maybe not the best person to answer that, but this question did come up in the Senate. I know we don't talk about the other body, but it did come up, and it's like they might start the Wednesday before Labor Day. That's not our business model. That's not what we do. When you talk to people, they always talk about their week at the lake, right? I mean, we're not the Ramada. And so our economics are driven by family vacations that are generally a week in nature. And so starting on Wednesday takes that time out. So if you ask us 31st versus the 1st, it's a difference without a distinction as it relates to the harm that we think we will experience with that, just shifting that date, because it takes up the entire time that we're concerned about.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair. Understood, and thank you for that answer. The 31st is a Monday in 2026, so it would still work within that particular model. I would like to see at some point, I know we're laying this, I think the intended action is to lay this over for further discussion. So I think it would behoove us to look at some of this data to see exactly how much, you know, these businesses would be affected. When really, when you look at comparing 2025's, Labor Day to August 31st of 2026, which is a reasonable time for a school district to start. It's right in that sphere. What really would the economic difference be for these resorts? I think it bears, just floating the question here, since we are going to be laying this over anyway. Thank you.
Representative Lawrence.
Chair Bennett, thank you very much. And I think our new representative brings up a good point, but I'm going to ask the inverse of that as well in regards to, if we're going to look at an economic benefit, let's also look at the educational benefit that 3 or 4 or 5 days may or may not have. And the reason I bring that up is because we've talked in this committee numerous times, and Representative Keeler and I have sat on the attendance and truancy committee. And one thing that's brought up over and over again is a cultural experience. And not only do we hear testimony today about a cultural experience, I think of many different cultural experiences that I've had growing up, not necessarily going to a cabin or going to a lake. But one of them that I've enjoyed most is the state fair. And the state fair is not represented here today, but the state fair always goes through Labor Day. And one of the things is that is the great Minnesota get-together, where I assume most people in this room have had a chance to attend at one point or another. But it is one of those cultural events that I think it affects our state. And if we're going to talk about cultural events and kids having time off from the school year for cultural events, I think these type of events, in my mind, in my opinion, also count as those cultural experiences with family and extended family, or experiences that need to be counted in as well. And so that's just my comment for the bill. Thank you.
Okay, Chair Jordan, go for it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a question for Chair Joachim, and it would, I guess we're all just going to call each other Chair now, to Representative Chair Joachim. Would school districts be able to set their calendars, if your bill became law, would school districts be able to differentiate their calendars based off of cultural events? For example, if a school district had a lot of kids in 4-H that were all showing at the state fair, would they still be able to accommodate that just based off of the school district should your bill become law?
Chair Bennett. Chair Jordan, that is a very good question, because we also have to think about the schools that are relying on busing in St. Paul for the state fair, which they would still be able to decide, okay, you know what, we can't do the busing right now, so we'll take that week off and fit that in. The basis of this is a few things. One, giving districts a chance to have some flexibility and see what happens. But mostly because we are, as been pointed out, one of the lowest. There's only 5 states lower than us in school days. And we have talked over and over again about how important it is to make sure our kids are educated to work in these businesses.
and be able to be productive members in society to help put money into our economy. And it's really hard to do in 165 days. And when it comes to the inverse that Representative Lawrence was talking about, we know from data and statistics that if a student misses 4 days in a month, they're less likely to graduate. So even though 3 or 4 days does not sound like a lot, it is. It's kind of like legislative time. A day is like a week's like a month. It means a lot for our kids to be in a classroom. So we have a choice here. You know, where do we do that movement? Do we do that movement to make sure our kids are in the classroom? Do we want to have that movement towards our businesses so they have more time, which I understand. Mr. Carlson was exactly right. For years, we did camping, and when we had a little bit more money, we did resorts. We don't have a lake cabin. We valued all those times with our students and our kids, and I was lucky. My husband was a teacher, so we had that chunk of summer. But our economy is changing. Family dynamics are changing. People that work full-time catch those few weeks over Christmas break or over a holiday break. And it's different for everybody. But our task here is to make sure our Constitution says we have to educate our children. That's a big mandate. And it has been, we want the flexibility in the calendar because we need that those days. Frankly, I'm with Representative Mueller. Year-round school with some bigger breaks in between, I think that would be great. But, and we do have some districts in the state that do that, that are on an innovation zone. I think Austin still does. But we need to be centered, as you've all said here, on the students and making sure that they have what they need in the class time. That all being said, too, I'm more than welcome to look at that flexibility. Even thought about that whole thing of it doesn't say how long they could go into August. We could maybe look at a date like you have to, you know, you can't go past, you have to start after the third week in August. More than happy to have that discussion. But this discussion that we keep having every year has to stop. We need to figure out what our kids need to make sure that we can be giving them the education they need and they can be productive members in our society. So that's kind of the whole point.
Chair Jordan, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, thank you for that. I think this is about making a schedule that works for your community. And so it's interesting that you brought up all year round schools. I actually attended an all year round school as a child. And so our school, my school, high school did start the last week of July. And we got 2 weeks off in October. We got a longer break at Christmas or Hanukkah, and we also got a longer spring break. During that time, I was, as a kid, you know, when I was a younger kid, I went to summer camp in Minnesota. That's actually how I fell in love with Minnesota, was coming to summer camp here. And then when I was older, I worked at a grocery store, and I still worked at that grocery store as a teenager. And so did my fellow peers at my high school, also worked at that grocery store and worked at the ice cream store, and did all those same jobs that teenagers do. And we did that well before Labor Day, and we also learned a lot in school. So I think it's a good idea. I do think the fact that it's only for 2 years means that we will continue to have this debate. But I think it's a good bill, and I'm glad that you're working on it, Representative Joachim.
Thank you. And I do have a question. I actually have a question for Joel Carlson. If he'd come back up again. Sorry, Mr. Carlson. And while he's coming up, I'll just make some comments because I've been listening to the conversations. And as a former teacher, mostly first grade, but I know how important every school day is to our children's education. And I'm a co-author on this bill. I think it's important when we're losing a significant chunk of time to allow districts to make some adjustments. So education is critically important, but we're dealing with two really important realms that are part of our state here. Education being one, I mean, I'm very pro-education, but also we have our businesses, our resorts, lodges, hotels, and so on up north that not only provide vacation areas, and I have friends who bring their little kids up every year to rent a cabin, and they love it, and it's such a great experience. Not everybody gets to do that, but we should have those options in our state. And the other thing is, and part of your realm, you help generate the taxes that fund education, so we can't just negate either, and I'm hoping we can find some happy medium here. So my question for Mr. Carlson is if there was some kind of language in this bill, Mr. Carlson, that named, that's temporary, it's a two-year thing just while Labor Day is late, that would say, but schools can't start before such and such. Would that help your group out? Go ahead, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, we'll have a genuine conversation among our resort association to see if there is some accommodation that that we can, you know, attempt to live with. In the past, that has just not been workable because of the seasons that we have. But I appreciate the competing interests that you're trying to balance, and I think it's a serious question, and it deserves serious reflection on our part, and we will do that.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And I know Chair Youakim she's good at working with people, so she'll consider these things. And it's tough because I see both sides, and they're both incredibly important. So, and sometimes it's hard to make things work for both groups, but hopefully we can.
I appreciate and always have appreciated the conversation that the Park Rapids School District is probably not going to start before Labor Day. The problem that we have, and it's a state problem, is that the people that are able to access our great resources through resorting don't come from Park Rapids. They come from Edina. They come from Princeton. And so when that opportunity is gone, that's what impacts your constituents. And so I don't want to leave with the impression that, well, that doesn't work for Park Rapids. They can start whenever they want. It's just optional. Because the loss of this opportunity is what impacts your constituents. And that's what we're trying to preserve as a state, this ability to have everyone access our great outdoors and not become the land of 10,000 lake accesses as opposed to 10,000 lakes. And so thank you, Madam Chair. We appreciate the thoughtful discussion.
Thank you. Chair Youakim, would you like to have some final comments?
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Sorry for looking at my phone. I'm supposed to be presenting in another committee right now. I think I already kind of did my wrap up with Chair Jordan's question. And I want to thank you, Representative Bennett, for being willing to hear this bill. And I will work with the folks here. Always happy to look at some bookends around that. Just because we do have to start. I mean, Colorado, where my son teaches, 180 days. I mean, 165 really needs to start looking to change, but that's a discussion for another day. Just would like some flexibility right now for our districts. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Youakim. And the Chair lays over House File 1124 as amended for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further consideration at a later date. And the next bill on the agenda is House File 1803. Representative Bakeberg, welcome back to the committee. And while he makes his way up, the chair moves House File 1803 before the committee with the chair's intent to lay over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further consideration at a later date. And Representative Bakeberg has an author's amendment. Members, we're going to adopt the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author prefers, and then Representative Bakeberg will present his bill as amended. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. So, Representative Bakeberg, please present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Great to be back in front of you today. My name is Ben Bakeberg. I have the privilege to represent the communities of Prior Lake Jordan, a portion of Shakopee, and the surrounding townships. House File 1803 proposes two changes to address special education requirements required by Minnesota state law or rule that goes beyond federal requirements. While the bill brings state laws and rules in line with the federal requirement, the primary goal, and I think this is something that those of us that work in schools understand, is to minimize, we're trying to balance here. We're trying to balance the paperwork load for case managers, but also that communication to families. So there's an important balance that we are trying to strike with this bill. And as the chair said, this is going to be laid over, so I invite ongoing conversation. First, the bill permits the IEP team with parental consent, and it's important that you note that the parents are a critical part of the IEP team. For those of you that aren't familiar, IEP stands for Individuals Education Plan. But it provides the IEP team with parental consent to delay a student's transition plan from secondary to post-secondary services from ninth grade until the student turns 16. This change not only reduces paperwork for our special education staff, but also ensures that transition planning is really more relevant to the student and the family. And my testifier will talk more about transitions for you. But that's really an important piece with this, that it's relevant to the student. So by allowing greater flexibility, the bill enables more meaningful and personalized planning while ensuring that we're reducing that paperwork burden. Second, the bill removes the requirement for benchmarks or short-term objectives for students who are not taking the alternate assessment while still maintaining the requirement for IEPs to include annual goals. One of those things that we're trying to balance is communication with families. So some will have expressed concerns, and very valid concerns, that removing the short-term objectives or those short-term objectives are essential for tracking a student's progress toward annual goals. But I think we have to keep in mind that educators, teachers, districts are already required to monitor and report on student progress through quarterly progress reports, parent-teacher conferences, and other accountability measures. The additional requirement for short-term objective increases the administrative burden on our special education teachers. And this is really the part that is important to me is when an educator is doing paperwork, they're not working with kids. And that's what we really want. And that's the magic that our teachers do. This burden takes away that direct instruction student support, even though teachers are already providing those regular progress reports and updates. So that will be my open, Madam Chair, and I turn it over to my testifier.
Okay, we have Michelle Kuka, Director of Student Support Services, Prior Lake Savage Area Schools. Go ahead and begin. Go ahead and introduce yourself, too.
Thank you, Chair Bennett and Chair Jordan and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Chuka, and I do serve as the Director of Student Support Services for the Prior Lake Savage Area School District, and I am here representing the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education. I'm here to express support for House File 1803. This bill brings Minnesota's special education requirements into closer alignment with federal law and provides much-needed paperwork relief to special educators across the state. As a special education administrator, I understand the critical importance of the Individualized Education Plan, or IEP. The IEP serves as a personalized roadmap for students with disabilities, fostering collaboration with families while ensuring legal protections and accountability. Under federal law, benchmarks or objectives are only required for students taking an alternative assessment, which is about 1% of a district's population. Minnesota, however, requires objectives for all students with IEPs. Removing objectives does not take anything away from students. It simply streamlines the process, allowing educators to focus on the most impactful components of the IEP, annual measurable goals and regular progress reporting. A well-written IEP goal is measurable, meaningful, and actionable. Ensuring the skill being measured is ambitious yet appropriate for the student, and that progress can be clearly tracked. I'll illustrate with an example. By March 2026, when presented with an unrehearsed fifth grade reading passage, Cindy will increase her rate of oral reading fluency from 84 correct words per minute to 121 correct words per minute with 95% accuracy for two consecutive data points, as measured by weekly progress report, monitoring tools of an oral reading fluency probe. This goal defines expected progress, the skill being measured, and how data will be collected. Adding two short-term objectives would not enhance a teacher's ability to measure or report progress. That's the goal part. All right, moving on to transition. I'm off. By law, districts must report IEP progress as often as general education progress is reported. For instance, in that example I gave you, a May progress for Cindy might say she's moved from 84 words correct per minute to 101 words per minute, showing she's on track to meet that goal. This bill does not change any progress reporting requirements, nor does it reduce the quality of updates to families. It just simply provides an option to eliminate redundant paperwork, allowing educators to focus more on instruction and student support. Now going on to transition planning. Current state law requires special education transition evaluations no later than ninth grade, placing a significant burden on the ninth grade case managers. Therefore, requiring many of these evaluations to instead occur in middle school to equalize the workload for special education teachers. This bill won't delay future planning for students. It simply ensures that special education transition evaluations occur closer to age 16, aligning with federal requirements when the information is more meaningful and more actionable. For years, you've heard about the overwhelming paperwork burden on special educators. Our goal remains the same, to do what is best for students. Reducing unnecessary paperwork means more time for instruction, intervention, and direct student support. These proposed changes enhance educator efficiency and ensure we focus on what truly impacts student achievement and long-term success. I urge you to support House File 1803, and thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Next, we'll move to our public testifiers. And when I ask you to come up and call your name, please state your name for the record and any organization you represent. And excuse me, I will also ask you to keep your comments to about 2 minutes. So we'll start with, I'm going to mess this name up here, but Marin Hofer and Laura Jean, if they would come up. So Marin Christensen Hofer.
Very good.
When you're ready, go ahead and introduce yourself and your organization and begin.
Thank you very much, Chair Bennett and Chair Jordan, and thank you, Representative Baker, for bringing this bill and for giving us the opportunity to comment on it. My name is Marin Christensen Hofer, and I am a parent of a child with a disability, and I also serve as the executive director for a nonprofit organization called the Multicultural Autism Action Network, which serves families of children with disabilities in our multicultural communities. And I'm here today to voice concerns about House File 1803, which would eliminate short-term objectives from IEPs, or individualized education plans, and also create an option to delay transition planning to age 16. We strongly believe that these steps are not in the best interest of students or their families. Short-term objectives serve several important functions in an IEP. First of all, they often describe how an IEP goal is to be met. We heard one example of an IEP, and I don't know how many of you were able to follow all that, but they can be pretty convoluted and pretty difficult to follow. So the short-term objectives often give us a lot of detail about how we're going to get from A to B. Secondly, they provide us with an opportunity to check in and see whether the child is on track and correct course if they're not. Without short-term objectives, parents lose access to information that is in the progress report. And it is important to note that it's correct to say that losing the short-term objectives does not change the frequency of the progress reports, but it does change the content a lot. It's withdrawing some pieces of information that can be vital to helping families understand whether their child is on track or not. And then the final piece that's really important to understand is that short-term objectives are often written in a much more transparent and user-friendly way. And I'd like to direct you to my written testimony, which you'll find in your packets, where I provide an example of just how cumbersome the goals can be written and how confusing they can be. And then also consider what that might look like if you are a parent who doesn't speak English as your first language, or perhaps you are a parent who has a disability themselves trying to make sense out of those goals. We're also equally concerned about the changes to transition age. The transition from youth to adulthood is an incredibly complex time for people with disabilities, and there's a reason that this period of time is referred to as the transition cliff. If we're pushing back that start date, even if we're making it optional, we're
potentially losing some of that valuable time to get those services in place. We're also very concerned that oftentimes when decisions are made in IEPs, parents are not giving affirmative consent to those changes. The default right now is that unless you specifically decline a change to an IEP, that IEP change will automatically go into place, unless it's the first one. And that's very confusing for parents. I would say at least 50% of the calls that our organization receives are from parents who are calling to say, the school made this change to my child's IEP and I didn't agree to it, not understanding that they have to specifically decline in order for those changes not to take place. I'll just wrap up by saying we completely agree that special education paperwork is a huge issue and it needs to be resolved. We're very willing to work together and collaborate to address that issue. Specifically, there were some meetings that took place that were hosted by Edmin last year that talked a lot about how can we address these paperwork issues. And the consensus among most of the people attending was that this is not about rolling back, you know, some of the regulations.
You could wrap it up pretty quickly.
Sure. Well, it's really about thinking about all the extra things we put into IEPs that are not required in state and federal law. And that's what we should really be focusing on. To do otherwise really does affect our students and our families. And as we know, they have a right to participation in the IEP process. And this is not the way to do that. Thank you.
Next, we have Laura Jean. And after that, we'll have Megan Ariola. So Laura Jean, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Begin. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Laura Jean. I'm the public policy coordinator for PACER Center and a manager of our parent training and advocacy program, helping parents understand their rights and responsibilities as they navigate the special education process. I am also the parent of two teenagers with disabilities. We welcome discussions about how to improve special education for students with disabilities and educators. However, today I'd like to express concern about the addition of this language, lines 2.7 through 2.8, unless the student's parent or guardian requests to delay the transition plan until the student turns 16. This addition is unnecessary and could be used to inappropriately persuade parents they should delay transition planning for a student with an IEP and to validate this delay. This language change undermines parents being able to participate as full members of their student's IEP team. Parents are at a disadvantage and often do not fully understand their rights and will defer to the IEP team members for recommendations regarding all aspects of that IEP. Transition planning is already complicated and nuanced within each school district throughout the state of Minnesota, making it challenging for parents to understand what must be included and provided in transition planning to meet the individualized needs of the student. When families contact PACER Center, they often do not understand what transition should or could look like for their student still in high school or in Transition Plus programs. While there is a breadth of options to help ensure these students receive the transition supports, services, and opportunities that should be afforded to them through their IEP to help them build the skills they need to pursue their post-secondary options and careers, what we typically see included is lackluster. The current language in the statute does not prevent IEP teams from delaying the inclusion of meaningful transition services. The vast majority of IEPs we help families review already do just that. Further delaying transition planning until age 16 does not allow enough time to ensure students with disabilities are adequately prepared to be successful in post-secondary education, employment, and independent living after high school. We also oppose the removal of requiring short-term objectives. Benchmarks and short-term objectives provide important information to parents and professionals to monitor progress toward achieving annual goals. It can be difficult for parents to know what steps are being taken to help their child build the skills they need as outlined in the IEP goals. Goals describe what skills need to be learned, when the skills will be used, and how progress will be measured. The benchmarks and short-term objectives help clearly communicate specific milestones during the year toward the larger goal. This is a great way to foster partnership between school staff, parents, and students. Parents can provide teachers feedback and information to help them better support students and reinforce what school is working on at home. These can also help students see their progress and feel successful, encouraging them to keep working hard to build the skills they need to achieve their goals.
You could wrap up pretty quickly. Thanks.
Last, if there are unexpected staffing changes, the objectives can provide staff with information they need to help provide students with consistent services to meet their educational goals. Again, it should be noted that the number of benchmarks and short-term objectives and how detailed they must be is up to the IEP team. As written, the law already allows ample flexibility for teams to determine what is appropriate for each student. Please vote no on these amendments. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Megan Ariola.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Megan Ariola, and I serve as the Legislative Policy Manager for the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to provide MDE's comments and cautions regarding HF 1803 before the committee today. First, I want to just say MDE recognizes the burden that educators face regarding special education paperwork, and this is a conversation that we are ready, willing, and rearing to have. MDE has supported and implemented several paperwork reduction initiatives in recent years, including reducing the size and scope of the total special education system documentation, reducing the special education program monitoring burden to focus only on annual performance indicators, and allowing the developmental physical education assessment and functional behavioral assessments to be conducted as standalones as opposed to requiring a full reevaluation. We would like to give caution to the committee regarding specifically the proposal to eliminate benchmarks and short-term objectives. Having benchmarks and short-term objectives in an IEP are valuable tools and information points for parents and students to have differentiated strategies, supports, and interventions in a timely and iterative process. IDEA, as has been discussed today, does set basic requirements for all IEPs, including the statement of annual measurable goals. Minnesota rule, which this proposal seeks to amend, largely does mirror those requirements set by federal law, and this is an additional requirement. We appreciate Representative Bigberg's amendment to address the alternative assessments issue that has come up in prior discussions, and we definitely look forward to following the language's evolution as it moves through the next few weeks of session. MDE does support retaining benchmarks and short-term objective for all students' IEPs in Minnesota rule and law. It is important to note that benchmarks, short-term objectives for those significantly cognitively impaired students taking those alternative assessments are still required by the IDEA regardless of any change that happens today. And we look forward to continuing the conversation about how to address the underlying issue of special education paperwork burdens. Thank you very much for the opportunity to provide comments. And as always, the department is ready for questions if that happens.
Thank you. That concludes public testimony. Members, do we have any member discussion? Okay. Chair Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Bakeberg, for bringing this forward. I think I'll mirror a lot of the testimony and saying, like, special education paperwork is real. When I talk to the special education teachers that I represent, they spend more time doing paperwork than they do teaching kids. And so I'm glad that we are attempting to take that on. So thank you for taking that on. I guess my questions, I do share concerns, though, that some of the testifiers expressed about parents. Like, it's difficult often to read IEPs, and parents rightly want to understand what's right for their kids. I guess my question would be, are you still working on this bill? Is there an opportunity to take some of that testimony back? I read through the written testimony, and I actually really want to commend Ms. Christensen-Hofer, because this is a really helpful piece of written testimony by actually taking out the, like, long-term goals and then showing how the short-term goals enhance that understanding of those goals. Is there a way, are we still working on this? Is there a way that we can, like, both address what parents need and what educators need with this?
Representative Bakeberg.
I am always, thank you, Madam Chair, members. Always willing to meet and talk. In the last committee, I said, you know, my office door is always open, and then I was corrected. I was walking away and said, you don't have an office, you have a cubicle. Yeah. So there is that. But yes, I mean, and frankly, this is what we should be doing. This is, you know, we had good discussion in committee in education finance about a different bill, and a member brought up something, frankly, that I had never thought of, because I read things through my lens. So this is the work of committee. So until a bill is, you know, passed off the floor and signed into law, like, we need to be continually working on it. And then when we realize that maybe something that was, we thought was really great in a previous session, we implement it and we're like, oh, maybe we got that one wrong. Then we need to come back and we need to tweak those things. So to answer your question, always, Representative Jordan.
Chair Jordan?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Bakeberg, for that. I guess I would just really encourage advocates to make this known. I think this is something we want to get right. I'm excited to dig more into that working group that was convened that talked about components of IEPs that are not mandated by either federal or state law, and then also just seeing whatever happens with federal plans as it relates to IDEA or the Federal Department of Education is a concern of mine. So making sure that we're looking at our IEP process and what is mandated by the feds and what might go away based off of federal action or inaction. So thank you for that.
Representative Bakeberg, final comments.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all agree that there's a burden on our special education teachers. And I've shared before, I distinctly remember my mom sitting at our kitchen table working on her IEPs late into the night. And she was just a conscientious, she wanted to make sure things were done well. She was worried about all the legal requirements. And now I see it every day in my professional job and trying to balance that. And it's real. I mean, the testimony that the people opposing this, that is a real concern. And we have to think about, how do we communicate effectively to our parents so that they understand what services are being provided to kids. I think there's a way that if we work together, we can do that. I look forward to working with all the stakeholders. One of the testifiers mentioned Edmund's working group. I'd love to see that feedback as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bakeberg. The chair lays over House File 1803 as amended for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further consideration at a later date. And we have our last bill up. Representative DePell, go ahead and make your way to the testifier table. House File 1457. And while he's making his way to the table, Representative DePell moves House File 1457 before the committee with the chair's intent to lay over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further consideration at a later time. So Representative DePell, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. Looking forward to speaking on House File 1457 and giving the testifiers an opportunity to speak on this as well. This is a bill that has been before the House and Senate multiple times. It's been conversed about and talked through. And ultimately, what this bill does is it puts kids ahead of convenience. When you think about building a school and giving children the opportunity to be healthy in their learning environment, making sure they aren't exposed to unnecessary harm from chemicals and dump sites and so on. And so I want to hand it over to our testifiers, take it from there, and then I'll take questions.
Okay, let's, Larry?
Yes.
Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Yeah, my name is Larry Lanou. I just come here as a concerned individual. I'd like to start by thanking the Education Policy Committee for once again hearing testimony on this bill, which limits new schools from being built within a quarter mile of a dump site or closed landfill. I'd like to also acknowledge former Representative Bob Detmer, who first wrote House File 2987 in 2012, to prevent a school from being built on a former listed Superfund site. He also chief authored this bill each session until he chose to retire, and I want to thank Representative DePell for picking this bill up and carrying it forward. I'd also like to acknowledge former Representative Carlos Mariani, who encouraged me not to give up on this bill, as the best legislation he has introduced took the longest time to pass into law, along with Representative Gene Wagenius, who stated it's the parents' right to know that the children and staff are being protected. Also, Representative Peggy Bennett and Representative Bob Bierman sitting here today, who has co-authored on this bill several times. Peggy, I think I probably ran into you 10 years ago and brought this forward. So I thank you for staying with it. This current version of House File 1457 has been modified to remove notification of parents and staff of existing schools exceeding residential limits of toxins established by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health. Simply stated, no school may be constructed on land that is located within a quarter mile of a dump site or closed landfill. It also defines dump site and closed landfill as being listed on the Pollution Control Agency website as a potentially contaminated site. In April of 2011, I was on a conference call at that time with Governor Dayton's office, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and myself, engage in preventing the discussion, preventing a school from being placed on a former Superfund site. And the question was asked, what is Aaron Brockovich's concern with about siting of an elementary school on a dump site? And I informed her that Aaron said she'd rather be known for preventing a school from being placed on a Superfund site rather than allowing one to be permitted on a dump site. Warning against placing the school on a dump site, informed them that cancerous diseases will start to show up in 10 to 18 years later if they continue and site a school on there, noting that no state agency will track and record the illnesses that are coming down the line. In October of 23, Fox News did a news article in the press with Matamidi School because they're hosting a benefit or awareness because there's a spike in leukemia in cancer patients in the school that was placed on that dump site. It's something that you would not want to happen to you, and I can assure that if it's your family member, you will not feel like it's a statistic or a coincidence. Just recently, on Thursday of March 6th of this year, just right on track with Aaron Brockovich's warning, we laid one of those Matamidi students to rest. He had contracted leukemia and passed on. And it's like Aaron says, no one's coming back and monitoring the harm we needlessly expose our kids when siting schools near dump sites. And rest assured that the most effective, cost-effective method to prevent and cure cancer is early prevention to cancerous environments, awareness of the hidden dangers once determined that a human risk exists, an opportunity for early detection that comes with the knowledge of one's surroundings. Currently, I've not found any state statute prohibiting the siting of new schools from being sited near existing former dump sites or closed landfills. It is left up to the local city and township zoning courts. As a member, former member of the Planning Commission and City Council, member of the City of Grant, we had an ordinance that prohibits building a landfill within 4,500 feet of a school. Ironically, it has no zoning ordinance from building a school to being built next to a dump site.
According to Pitts. Linu, if you could kind of wrap up here just to
I'm
keep
getting
things
to the
moving.
End if I can. I've got 14 years invested, so if I'm a little lengthy.
We need to keep it moving, though, so we can get some good discussion. Thank you. Okay.
According to Pitts, people investigating toxic sites, California is the number one school located near dump sites, Minnesota's number two in the nation. Your child should be as safe at school as they are at home, and the principles of citing schools are children are more sensitive than adults, and that every precaution be taken. They ingest more air, and they're more sensitive to putting there. And there is no government agency that will accept liability for citing a school near a toxic site that exceeds residential limits. In fact, after reviewing, their insurance policies excludes coverage from pollution. So often, as regulatory agencies reevaluate whether remedial conditions were completed years ago sufficiently to protect human health and the environment, all too frequently, to the contrary, many of those are being reopened. In preventing construction within a quarter mile of a contaminated site, identify the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency as potentially contaminated site, protects the seal of the sites from being broken. Not allowing utility lines such as sewer, water, electric, natural gas, and communications to run through contaminated soils prevents toxic plumes from getting access to travel downstream, putting an undue burden on its community to provide clean water. As an update, I would like to also thank Senator Jason Rarick and Senator Mary Kunish for both co-authored this bill in the House as representatives and have chief-authored this bill in the Senate, along with Senator Steve Swedensky, Chair of Education Policy, that has also co-authored this bill and has moved this bill to be laid over for inclusion on a vote. I ask once more that this bipartisan legislation be passed with a unanimous vote, which allows you to protect the health, safety, and welfare of your constituents, which is what we have all sworn to do as elected officials. I'd like to thank you once more for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Wayne Serapo?
Yes.
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Wayne Serapo. I'm simply a concerned citizen speaking in support of HF 1457. I've been a resident of Grant, Minnesota for 37 years. I have a BA in biology from LaSalle University in Philadelphia and an MA in limnology from St. Cloud State University. I worked as an environmental consultant for 10 years prior to starting work at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I worked at the MPCA for 35 years in a variety of programs, including wastewater treatment, landfills, site assessment program, the state Superfund program, the federal Superfund program, and the voluntary investigation and cleanup program. I state all these background issues just to tell you that my experience has shown me it's really hard to clean up a contaminated site. I know firsthand that it's very difficult and expensive and time-consuming, and I'm here today in support of this bill because the language in this bill will help to prevent further exposure to contamination, which results in a toll on human health that is even more difficult to remedy. Further, I do not think there's a need to put language in the bill to require a school to spend money. The reason being, for example, is that if a school district is planning to construct a new school, planning field, stadium, or what have you, the presence of any VIC fuel oil sites or Superfund sites will be discovered during the initial planning process. What we want to accomplish in passing this bill is to make it very clear that no construction can occur on or within a quarter mile of the proposed school-related construction. So in closing, I respectfully request that you pass this bill. This is the third time I've appeared before you folks in support of this bill. And while I enjoy coming down here to see democracy in action, and I love to see all you folks hard at work, and I do appreciate your hard work, I do encourage you to pass this bill. Thank you for allowing me to speak on its behalf.
Thank you. And we do have two public testifiers, Kirk Kudelka and Pam Anderson, if they could make their way up and ask you to, or remind you to state your name and any organization you represent, and try to keep your comments to 2 minutes. Thank you. We'll start with Kirk Kudelka. Hope I'm saying your name correctly.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kudelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and my colleague here with me also. We're just going to take team on this real quick and just cover a couple pieces of this. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to share some information as you consider this bill moving forward. We just wanted to let folks know that contaminated sites and the possible uses for properties are never the same. The two combinations are always different, which is why it's our recommendation that any development, school or otherwise, perform due diligence for an environmental assessment to make sure any remediation matches the situation. There's nothing magical about a quarter of a mile. A site within a quarter of a mile could have no impact on something within that distance, and sites that are miles away, such as our Twin Cities Army Munitions Plant in Arden Hills, impacts communities farther away. So that's why our recommendation really is to have the environmental assessment for any types of development projects. We have a map that we've provided to the committee just to show the number of sites that there are around the state so that folks have that understanding. And I'm going to pass it over to my colleague real quick just to talk about how that environmental assessment is done and what services MPCA offers to schools and others to provide protection for human health and the environment.
Thank you. Pam Anderson.
Chair and committee members, my name is Pam Anderson. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I'm the director for our remediation division for our land cleanup programs. Our brownfields program exists to kind of fill this hole. So when you have development that is underway, lenders often are looking for assurance that you are doing your due diligence to make sure that something is ready to move forward and they're willing to put money behind it. between 200 and 500 applications come in each year. We provide technical assistance. They submit to us an environmental site assessment that is a records review, a look at the site, and their development plans. We take a look at those. We determine what the lay of the land looks like, what the information is, and determine a path forward. It might require monitoring to determine what contaminants are there, and then once those are found, what are the next steps to remove those contaminants or to address and mitigate it so that development can occur safely on the property. This is something that we do across the state. It could be schools, it could be businesses, and it's here to allow our lands to be reused safely and so that we can get the benefit from the public to have these lands back in production versus being vacant lots.
Thank you. Appreciate the information. Members, do we have any member comments or questions? Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. And thank you, Representative Capel, for bringing this bill forward for discussion. You know, I love when we talk about keeping kids safe, and especially when it comes to the environment. You know, there's a lot of work that Representative Faulkner is doing on environmental issues, so I love that. I'm curious about part of this bill, and that is, like, how does this bill impact schools that currently sit on landfills?
Representative DePell.
Currently does not affect schools that sit on landfills. However, as Mr. Kadelka mentioned, they do have a process to determine whether or not they're safe. Now, there is a question about to what level should we allow that to occur? Should we allow the same levels to exist in school properties that exist in a residential neighborhood or commercial? Because that's really different. Commercial properties are allowed significantly higher levels of pollution in their soil, and whether that's gases that are escaping. And so I think that brings forward a really important discussion of pre-existing circumstances, but this bill does not specifically address that.
Representative Green, follow up.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the reason I ask is, from my understanding here, it means like there's no new, and it also includes new construction, right? So, like, for example, Minnetonka High School sits on a landfill and has for the last 50 years. So if they were to put an addition on that school, according to this bill, they would not be allowed to do that, even if our pollution control agency cleared it. Is that correct?
They would be able to do... Thank you, Chair Bennett. They would be able to do that if they remediated the site and cleaned it up. There are multiple different ways of doing that. You can cap a site, and this, again, would be something that was determined through the PCA, and again, Mr. Kadelka could speak to that, but you can put a layer of clay over that land. You can remediate it with membranes. You can dig everything up, but that's actually an issue too, because you can redisturb what's already in the ground, and so you want to make sure that you're not causing harm in that process. But that is something to consider as well. So what I would emphasize is we want the safety of the students to be paramount, and that, I think, would be something that Minnetonka would want also. They would want their students to be safe. They wouldn't want to disturb ground that might otherwise cause greater pollutants. And, again, it may be seen as inconvenient, but I believe, again, we should be putting the safety of students ahead of a degree of convenience.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair. I guess I'm confused then, because what you just said was that they could build on a school on the site that's already on a landfill, based on what you said, if they work with the pollution control agency. But then there's like 275 schools across the state that are already on landfill. So all of those schools that they wanted to build on would be able to do that.
Only if they...
Representative DePell.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. Only if they adequately remediated those sites and brought them to a level that was appropriate. So again, if you go back to and you consider what commercial property is considered as and what is appropriate for a commercial property to be built on. That is the same as a public school. Now, these children are inhabiting the buildings for an extended period of time, and we want to make sure that they're safe, obviously. We don't want them breathing in toxic fumes and things of that nature that are going to cause them greater harm. However, there are processes that have been put in place, as Commissioner Kadelka has mentioned. And within those, I also want to mention one other item on that. So the current density within, for instance, the urban metro area is about 8,000 people per square mile. And enrollment in the Minneapolis metro area specifically, where that number is taken from, enrollment numbers were somewhere around 47,000 students in 2001. Now, enrollment numbers today are at about 23,000. So the concern that they would have to add on in these areas where I'm sure you have this map that you're looking at, where are we going to put the kids, that kind of thing. Those buildings are extremely underutilized right now. So the potential that they would have to add on to or build in those sites is very low. If you look in the area of Minnetonka, there's a lot of land that would be accessible to large amounts of children that could be built on that wouldn't be built on a dump site.
Representative Green.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate letting me follow up quite a bit, Chair. I appreciate that. Commissioner, would you like to, can I bring the Commissioner up for a question?
Commissioner? Go ahead and ask your question, Representative Green, and then we'll have the Commissioner respond.
Thank you, Chair. So, Commissioner, I'm just trying to understand what the limitations are on this bill, because it feels like I'm hearing two different things. So, if you can mitigate land on a property, that the school property that's already there, and you can expand on it on that same property and treat it and prepare it so that it is safe for kids, because we all agree we want it to be safe, what's the difference then with a new property?
Commissioner, if you could state your name again for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, Kirk Adelko with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The author did a good job of explaining our response action plan, which my colleague talked about, where you investigate, then address remedial actions to address those issues and to make it safe for human health and the environment. However, this bill says that doesn't apply. This just says you can't build on something within a quarter mile, so our environmental assessment process does not move forward. It doesn't make a difference what what the plan would say or the agency's approval.
Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair. I think you just cleared up. I was confused about what those limitations meant for a quarter mile, because the mitigation efforts that the Pollution Control Agency does is what I would want to follow to keep our kids safe. So I appreciate your answer.
Thank you. So Chair Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of want to go back to what Representative Green was talking about. This does impact existing schools. And you talk about MPS, which is a district that I represent. They have done a lot of analysis on their current buildings. And they, you know, this idea that, like, the 2001 number of buildings is not what is currently being dealt with in Minneapolis. So they have made adjustments on their enrollment for schools. And one thing I know right now is there are schools that want to build new playgrounds, for example. And this would prevent them from being able to do that, as the commissioner just said. So I think a lot of the questions have been answered. This does pertain to new construction. It does impact existing schools. It impacts at least four Minneapolis public school buildings that, if they wanted to do things like a playground or soccer fields, they wouldn't be able to do that. The other thing, too, is this quarter mile doesn't really account for environmental realities. You know, things like ground vapor, watersheds, wind patterns do not account for that quarter mile radius. Or the wind doesn't use the metric system or the imperial system to, like, measure distances. It's the wind. Watersheds are influenced by the way our watersheds exist. So I think it's laudable to care about the environments that our children are learning in. And we can do that by supporting things like a ban on non-essential use of PFAS. We can generate less waste and have fewer landfills to put things in. We can hold corporate polluters accountable. We could also care for our children's health by making sure they have access to wraparound services and school meals at school to improve their health. This bill is not really one that I think it needs a lot more work. I know there's been a lot of work done over the years, but this bill is not one that's going to help our school buildings, and it's not really one that's necessarily going to make our children's lives healthier. We're talking about much more than just the buildings here. So I would not support this bill. I'm glad that it's being laid over. So hopefully you can work with, you know, Commissioner Kadelka, who has a wealth of knowledge on solid waste issues. So I'd encourage you to meet more with him and work more with him on this. And this just isn't really a bill that works necessarily as written. So I'm glad that's being laid over. If it's going to come back, I did speak to Chair Fisher of the Environment Committee, and he would also need to hear it. So if it comes back, it would need to go into Environment, but I would not be voting for it to move. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative DePell, go ahead and give your final comments as answer whatever you'd like.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. So one thing that I want to stress is there's been a lot of conversation about buildings and a lot of conversation about playgrounds and expansion, but not a lot of conversation about the actual health of the children. And respecting the health of the children should be the first and top priority, not the convenience of building something that is on a dump site. If you consider your own selves, if you were looking for a home to buy and somebody told you this is a dump site that has toxic chemicals in it and it could have gases leaking out of the soil and it could settle and it could become compacted and more toxic waste could get into your home as you sleep at night, you might likely say, I think I'll pass on this. I think I don't want to build either on this or right next to it. And I'm making some assumptions here. That's my personal sense. I wouldn't want to do that. And I believe as members of this committee, they likely wouldn't want to do that either. So this bill puts children first, not buildings, and not convenience. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative DePell. The chair lays over House File 1457 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further consideration at a later date. Members, that concludes today's agenda. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 19th. With that, the committee stands adjourned.